Ready to proceed with Harris County Hospital District case. The appellant is ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The hospital district's claims were released and resolved almost 20 years ago in the Morales class action. The hospital district admits that its claims today are the same claims resolved in Morales. It does not dispute that it received a class notice, and it concedes that it took no action 2 decades ago to challenge or otherwise object to the class settlement and release. Instead, the district waited 10 years, then filed this challenge on the basis of 2 incorrect legal theories. First, the hospital district argues that Section 281.056 exempts it from the preclusive and res judicata effect of Morales. Second, the hospital district argues that Morales is void for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Both of those arguments are wrong. I'd like to address them in turn. Section 281.056 does not exempt the hospital district from Morales. Any argument about that statute should have been raised 20 years ago in a challenge to the settlement, but the district didn't do that. It waited 10 years to raise this point, and that's fatal because the district cannot overcome res judicata. Nothing in the statute indicates that it upends res judicata. The statute is not jurisdictional, and the hospital district doesn't claim otherwise. And the only case the district cites, the American Pipeline case from the 1940s, is not a res judicata case. Moreover, nothing in 281.056 speaks to the consequences for failing to comply. Nothing in that statute indicates that judgments may subsequently be vacated. The district has no authority to support its view that 281.056 allows it to opt out of Morales decades after the fact.
What do you make of the argument that the PUC had exclusive jurisdiction back then, and therefore the Morales settlement was void? I mean, what are we supposed to do with that?
Well, Your Honor, that argument is incorrect, and I'm happy to shift gears and address that argument at this time.
If it's coming in a different part, I can wait.
It is. I'll address it now since Your Honor's asked about it. There's plenty more I'm happy to say about 281, but I'll shift gears to jurisdiction. The district's argument that Morales is void for lack of subject matter jurisdiction is not correct. It's wrong because the district court in that case, and only the district court, had jurisdiction over the fraud and deceptive trade practices claims that Morales involved. Now, the Supreme Court has recognized numerous times that the PUC does not have jurisdiction to resolve tort claims, and especially not claims for fraud and deceptive practices. Those claims must be brought in court. That's the rule from the 2007 Southwestern Bell case. More recently, in the Chaparral Energy case last year, the Supreme Court endorsed the Fort Worth Court of Appeals construction of the PUC's exclusive jurisdiction in the Giovanni Holmes case. That case held that the PUC had jurisdiction only over the breach of contract claim presented in that case. It did not have jurisdiction over the tort claims that were ancillary. And there's good reason why that's true. Fraud claims are serious matters. They belong in front of a state judge, not an administrative official. That's why the federal rules, for example, require fraud claims to be pleaded under a higher standard of pleading. Moreover, when we look at the elements of fraud in Texas, we see that none of them fall within the PUC's expertise. The elements are, one, a material misrepresentation that was intended to be acted upon, that was relied upon, and that caused injury. The PUC is not in a position to adjudicate any of those elements. That's why it's black letter law that the PUC does not adjudicate fraud claims. In addition to that, this court held in the Lubin case that when a plaintiff asserts several causes of action, so long as some of those causes of action are not committed to the PUC's exclusive jurisdiction, then the district court is not divested of its subject matter jurisdiction. That rule flows from the principles that the U.S. Supreme Court articulated in the Matsushita case and this court relied on. Now, applying those principles here, it's clear that Morales was not a dispute about the PUC-approved tariff, but it was instead about fraud and deceptive trade practices. And you don't have to take my word for it. The Morillas class complaint itself began by saying that it was a case about fraud and deceptive trade practices, and those claims belong in district court. Now, the district's position fundamentally misunderstands the law. According to the district, any time a case touches in any way on any issue within the jurisdiction of the PUC, then the district court lacks subject matter jurisdiction and any judgment it enters is necessarily void. But the district does not cite a single case supporting that rule. Its best case is the Supreme Court's decision in In re Southwestern Bell in 2007. But that case merely held that the PUC has exclusive jurisdiction over a claimed violation of PURA related to charges collected under the Texas Universal Service Fund. The district also cites last year's decision in Chaparral Energy. But again, that was a breach of contract claim arising out of the defendant's alleged failure to, quote, provide additional electric facilities sufficient to provide electric service, end quote. Not only does the district lack authority for its position, but its view is inconsistent with the Supreme Court's decision in the Engelman case just 2 years ago. Let's set all of this aside. Even if we are wrong about the Chaparral Energy case and the hybrid claims resolution process, the district still loses under the Supreme Court's reasoning in the Engelman case. Under Engelman, the arguments the district raises are not enough to invalidate a decades-old and long-settled judgment. Engelman discussed what it called the modern trend against retroactivity, striking judgments on the basis of subject matter jurisdiction. Engelman relied on Section 12 of the Second Restatement of Judgments. Now, Section 12 of the restatement explains that parties cannot subsequently attack subject matter jurisdiction except under very limited conditions, one of which is, quote, the subject matter of the action was so plainly beyond the court's jurisdiction that its entertaining the action was a manifest abuse of authority, end quote. This case is not even close to that standard, and the district can't seriously claim that it is. The Supreme Court did not announce the Subaru case until 2002. That was 2 years after Morellas. It announced the Southwestern Bell case in 2007, 7 years after Morellas. And Engelman, which the district cites as being dispositive, of course, was decided last year, almost two decades after Morellas. Under Engelman, and the restatement provision that it relied on in validating Morellas would be manifestly improper. In the administrative proceedings in this case, the commissioners expressly lamented the fact that the jurisdictional issue was confusing and unclear. It's impossible for it to be a manifest abuse of authority in that situation. Now, to sum all this up, the district wants to take a very broad conception of subject matter jurisdiction and apply it very broadly based on one case decided last year that obliquely references an issue that this case presents, but in a different context. That is contrary to Engelman.
Excuse me, counsel. Has the permissibility of the fees ever been adjudicated by any tribunal?
The permissibility of the fees.
The fees, so the underlying fees that I guess kind of were part of the fraud and all the other claims to begin with, have those fees ever been decided on by a court? Whether or not they were permissible or not, or
I don't believe that a court has passed on that precise legal question. Of course, the allegation in Morellas, Your Honor, is that those fees were deceptively presented and that the customers were defrauded. AT&T chose to settle that action. I don't believe there was an admission of liability in settling the action, but of course the settlement occurred before there was any sort of formal adjudication of that underlying issue.
Okay, thank you.
Unless there are further questions, I'm happy to yield the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Hawkins.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Everybody's looking at me. I don't know how you guys divided your time. So.
Now I've forgotten. Sorry, Your Honor. I've seen her waiting for the turnaround.
Why we like the 15 and 5. We can remember.
I'm good with the 15 and 5.
Morning, Ms. Hayes.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. The Harris County Hospital District would very much like the law to be applied consistently. And there are clear, hard, fast rules of law that this case raises that should be so applied. And this is a hard case. It is this collision of jurisdictional tenets, the issue of the representation of governments, and class actions. But when you drill down in the analysis and look at what issues of law are at issue, are at stake, and the facts and the procedural history of the case, it becomes an easier case to decide. Morales was a Cypress settlement class, and it spawned a whole litany of problems. The PUC incorrectly alleges in its brief there was a lone objector. There were a lot of objectors. And it's not at all to me unusual that this case should still be lurking around in one form or another, given how it unfolded at the time. And
is there a fact question or dispute as to whether the hospital district had notice back in the day? I mean, there was some discussion about whether the lawyers did, but I wasn't clear on the record.
You know, in truth, I don't know if they did or not, but as a matter of law, it's irrelevant. Because at the time when Morales was going into settlement, and you can see this in the settlement hearing transcript that's in the record, there was a lot of deal-making going on up to the last moment to try to knock out the other objectors. The one lone objector that is referenced, that I believe he's referencing in his brief, was a company, the acronym of which is STA, which was a company that audited phone bills. I mean, misbilling in phone bills was such a thing, a whole industry sprung up during the 90s. And STAR had assignments from many, many, mainly institutional, commercial customers and governmental customers for their claims against AT&T. A Rule 11 agreement was read into the record where those institutional customers would be carved out of the Morales settlement. And that's why there was a separate class action filed the next day that went on and was litigated until 2010. And this case, this Harris County case that we're talking about, was filed right before the STA motion for rehearing was ruled on. So it is false to say that the Harris County Hospital District laid around for 10 years waiting. The Harris County Hospital District, to the extent it would have or did, or it doesn't matter if it did or not, thought it was part of that case, but thought it had a claim, would have thought it was part of the STA case. AT&T itself, in its pleadings in the STA case, and I've submitted excerpts of this in the attachments to the reply brief, listed out who they believed to be a member of the STA class action and not the Morales class action, and specifically listed HCHD in that. And when you compare both petitions, the Morales petition and the petition in this case, you can see how much the claims overlap. We don't dispute at all they're the same claims. We embrace it. So I'm not going to spend any time discussing that. And I'll back up a little bit, and let's talk about how should any court, now or 30 years ago, analyze the jurisdictional issues. There's also a lot of allegations that this was case law that happened after the fact. It's not fair to apply it to something that happened in 1998. This whole jurisdictional argument is based on a statute that was enacted in 1975 that gives the PUC exclusive original jurisdiction over the property of telecommunications. And it's a broader statute than even the jurisdiction it has over electrical utilities. And we don't have to go post-1998 to find cases, or 2000 when the settlement happened, that contain the same analysis that we're urging on the court today. This court in 1997 held that you should look at how the case is pled, not the cause of action, but how is the case pled? And I'm going to pause a minute and define a term, because I think where this case gets harder and more confusing is people use claims to mean three different things. They mean it to mean cause of action. They mean it to mean cause of action plus my facts and theory of the case. Or they mean it to use it to mean my damages claim from my fraud claim or DTPA claim. So I'm going to try to be very precise in how I use it in this discussion. A cause of action is a tort or breach of contract. An issue, whether it can be fact or law, that underlies that cause of action. My theory of the case brings those together. Add that all together, the cause of action and my theory of the case, and I get my claim. So what were the claims in Morales? If you look at the petition in Morales, every single claim, fraud or not, revolves around whether or not AT&T legally charged the municipal fees or went back to their customers. Every single claim. That's the core fact issue and legal issue for Morales. It's the core fact and legal issue for this case. And most importantly, only the Public Utility Commission can decide that issue. No, not any other tribunal. And for that reason, every single claim in both Morales and this case is subject to the PUC jurisdiction first. Chaparral, which came out last year, is most useful for laying out a very clear analytical framework for how a court should look at, does an agency have jurisdiction or should this go to a trial court? First, is there an explicit grant of authority of exclusive jurisdiction? Here there is in that 1975 statute. It explicitly says exclusive original jurisdiction. Second, is there a pervasive regulatory scheme? You cannot have an explicit grant, and if you have a pervasive regulatory scheme, the court can find the agency has jurisdiction. Here we also have a pervasive regulatory scheme in PURA. Then the court should review the claims in that particular case, not just check boxes, is it tort or is it breach of contract? What's the theory of the case? And then identify, what's this case really about? What is it that a court or a tribunal would need to decide to resolve the claims? And here it's whether or not those municipal fees were legally charged. Then if the court determines that the claims can only be resolved by an issue committed to an agency's jurisdiction, then that party has to go exhaust administrative remedies first, or a trial court has no jurisdiction. And part of their argument is under Lubin and Mashuda, because if some of the claims can go to the trial court, then it's okay. The settlement can be approved of by the trial court. Problem here is that none of the claims do. And my colleague and I sat at breakfast and tried to think of, is there ever a claim against the PUC, given how broad the utilities code provision is written, where that would be the case? And about all we could come up with is a car wreck that has nothing to do with how you charge utility fees. That goes to their decision-making ability or the decision-making jurisdiction on whether tariffs are properly implemented or fees properly charged, if it underlies a cause of action, as pled by a particular plaintiff, has to go to the agency first. And in those claims that are dependent on agency jurisdiction, cannot be ruled on by a trial court. And you can see that in the trial court's decision here, although the trial court was a little fuzzy in his use of claims. He referred to the damages claims or abated. He doesn't mean damages cause of action. He means damages. That's what's abated. Because, of course, the PUC can't issue damages for a DTPA claim or a fraud claim, but they have to determine that legal and factual issue that underlies the liability of every single claim in this case and in the Morales case. And I'll shift to the second main issue of the case, the one we prevailed on before, and that is the statutory scheme, if I will, that surrounds governmental representation. There's also some comments in the briefs about there's not a special rule for governments. Yeah, there is. Governments are treated very differently by the courts because they're sovereigns. And under Texas law, local governments are treated differently based on what they are. Counties are very different things under Texas law than cities. So with beyond a doubt, cities can be parts of class action. And I think a lot of counties thought they could until the MERS Corps case from the Northern District, which I think may have been the first time that issue was really brought to the head because the class was entirely made up of counties. That case, along with the Fifth Circuit case, Ackle, refused to allow counties to participate or governmental entities to participate in a class action because of statutes that restrict their representation. And here, it's not simply 281056 in the Health and Safety Code that governs the hospital district. And yes, there is no case directly on point to that specific statute because this is the first time the issue's ever arisen. instead look at the statutory scheme. There's a whole litany of statutes that restrict representation of counties, starting with 281.056, and let's look at the plain language of it. The county attorney shall represent the district in all legal matters. Shall represent, that's mandatory. The board may employ additional counsel, not replace the county attorney, but additional counsel.
As you go through these, could you comment on what the source might be for a proposition that these are jurisdictional?
Yes, I will, and I'll quickly hit the other two and move to your question. Government Code 45201, which is specific to county, the Harris County. The primary duty of the county attorney in Harris County is to represent the state, Harris County, and the officials in all civil matters pending in the courts of Harris County and any other courts in the state, the county, or the officials that may have matters pending. 89001, which was integral to the MERS court decision, special counsel in Populous County. Large counties in Texas, the commissioner's court may employ a special counsel, but, quote, the county attorney shall select the special counsel. Why the county attorney? Because it's a constitutional office with powers. And this litigation is less common now than it was in the early to mid 20th century. But there have often been fights over who has the power to speak for the king, who can act for the government. And only the county attorney, under constitutional provisions and statutory provisions, can decide when the county can participate in a case.
Is it possible to have representation without actually making an appearance in court?
It is possible. Let's say Mr. Bray and I appear in court and we don't have Vince Ryan on the pleading. Yes, but we still have to act at his direction. We can't file that lawsuit or start it without the elected county attorney's direction to file the case. And even then, AT&T itself has absolutely required, argued successfully in the Public Utility Commission, which has a special rule that allows others to represent someone in fee disputes, that Mr. Bray could not represent Harris County without a county attorney also joining the case. So they argued that took this position, the same position we're taking now, and were successful with it in the PUC, and now want to flip around and have the law apply inconsistently and not require the county attorney's presence for Harris County Hospital District to be in a case. I'm sorry, Your Honor, it's taken, my brain is not quite getting to my cases. First, to the consequence of a lack of representation by the county, it is void. And this case law is much more rare than the mountain of cases that hold if you do not have jurisdiction, your orders are not void, as we believe both the Morales orders final judgment is. But the American Liberty Pipeline case, along with the Bickham case. American Liberty was a case out of this court. It's binding precedent. It analyzed the long line of cases that talks about this constitutional powers of elected officials and who can speak for the king, the local governments, and Texas courts. And it comes to the same conclusion those cases did, that the consequences of not following the representation statutes is a lack of jurisdiction and void orders. Secondly, the Bickham case, that was out of the Dallas Court of Appeals, analyzed the requirements for constitutional county attorneys to represent the state, and rightly noted this authority cannot be abridged and taken away. That language is from the Maud case, which is a Texas Supreme Court case from the 19th century. This is a long-standing tenet of Texas law about the powers of county and district attorneys to represent counties. And Bickham goes on to say, nor can the state be represented by any other person unless the state's attorney joins, or the district court is without jurisdiction to entertain the suit. In the briefing, the PUC sought to distinguish 281.056 from the provisions in Chapter 44 of the Government Code governing criminal district attorneys, because those statutes use the phrase exclusively represent the state. And their argument is because that magic word exclusively is not in 281.056, then it's really not exclusively. But if you look at the language of 281.056, shall represent in all legal matters, that is mandatory. If you look at the use of exclusively represent in Chapter 44, those words have two purposes. They mean both mandatory, DA's got to be there, and no one else can do it. There's not a no one else in 281056 because it does allow additional counsel, not to the exclusion of the county attorney, but additional counsel. And even then, with Chapter 44, you still have something under Texas law of a prosecutor per se. A DA can recuse, and a private lawyer can be appointed to represent them, acting in the shoes of the district attorney to exclusively represent the county. And I see my time is up, so I'll hold for rebuttal.
Find a wrap-up spot if you'd like to.
No, I'm good.
Your Honor, I'll divide my rebuttal time with counsel for AT&T. Just a few points, first on 281 and then on the jurisdictional question. First, the district insists that MERS Corp and ACL require the rule that they've proposed, and those cases do no such thing. As to the MERS Corp case, that is not a res judicata case. That is a federal court decision interpreting a different statute, and it was decided, most importantly, in the context of a motion for class certification. Now, we think that MERS Corp is wrong on the law. The parties before that federal court did not present the arguments that we've briefed and that we present to this court today. But even if MERS Corp is correct, it would only be relevant if Morellas were being litigated today, not 20 years ago. MERS Corp says nothing about what you do about a 20-year-old judgment. ACL has the exact same problem. That was a direct appeal. It says nothing about res judicata. It's not a res judicata case. And the statute, the Louisiana statute at issue in ACL, is completely different because it is prohibitive in nature, unlike 281, which is permissive in nature. That statute said no parish governing authority shall retain or employ any special attorney or counsel to represent it in any special matter. That's restrictive framing. In Texas, we have permissive framing. If their attorney did not represent them in this proceeding, that is between them and their attorney. There is nothing in 281 that says that they can come along after the fact and claim that that lack of representation leaves them unbound by the Umbrella's judgment. Now, Chief Justice Rose asked an important question. What case do they have that says the 281-056 is jurisdictional? They provided nothing. The two cases that they cited, American Pipeline and the Bickham case, are not jurisdiction cases. They are not res judicata cases. They do not require this court to go back and invalidate a judgment 20 years ago on the basis of a statute not at issue in those cases. They don't have a single case requiring what they're asking this court to do, and that is why their position is literally unprecedented. I also would like to note that their position invites a number of very strange results. For example, Texas law provides that attorneys must zealously represent their clients. Well, if I could show a court that my personal attorney was not doing that, would I be able to get out of any class action settlement? Under the district's view, the answer is yes. But if that's right, then class actions wouldn't exist because they would be too vulnerable to collateral attack. Likewise, the Texas law of for-profit corporations provides that the board of directors shall direct the business and affairs of the company. But if the district's position is right, then any business bound by a judgment could invalidate it years later by showing that its board didn't vote on the action. That's inconsistent with the purpose of Rule 42, and it would upend class action practice in the state if accepted by this court. I'll move on very briefly to the jurisdictional arguments. My colleague on the other side brought up the text of PURA, but she omitted to note the preamble language, which I think is very important. This is section 52.002. Exclusive jurisdiction is conferred for the purpose of, quote, in order to, quote, regulate rates, operations, and services. That's the purpose of exclusive jurisdiction, and that purpose is not implicated in a fraud case. As we've seen in Southwestern Bell and Subaru, and in Chaparral, it is implicated in a breach of contract case over what the proper rate is, but it's not implicated in a fraud case where the question is, did you lie to me or not about what rate was permissible?
What if you had a billing case where there's an allegation of improper billing? Would that be a PUC matter, or could you take that to district court?
Your Honor, I take that to be a question about Whether or not the tariff rate is the correct rate or the incorrect rate, that sounds from your hypothetical like that's something that would be at least subject to the primary jurisdiction of the PUC, but of course that's not what was at issue in Morales. I'd also like to touch briefly on counsel's arguments regarding the CyPray nature of the settlement. Counsel's arguments at the podium and in briefing suggest that there was something unfair about this CyPray class action. But what counsel has not noted is that fairness was thoroughly litigated in Morales, and the district court's fairness determination was explicitly upheld in the Northrop case, and the ChemJet case, which we discussed in our brief, subsequently recognized the Northrop court's holding that the Morales settlement was fair. Now, if this class action settlement is to be invalidated, it is almost impossible to think of how we would unscramble that omelet 2 decades after the fact. Presumably, given these fairness determinations, many Morales class members and other entities are quite pleased with the settlement's results. And this raises a host of questions. Do the beneficiaries of those payments have to cut checks to AT&T if the district prevails in this action? AT&T paid out millions of dollars to libraries in Central Texas through the Telecommunications Infrastructure Fund Board. Do those libraries have to return the money? The district hasn't answered that question, and I'm not sure that anyone knows the answer, but that's the can of worms that will be opened by invalidating this 2-decades-old class action judgment. Finally, Chief Justice Rose, you asked whether there was a fact dispute regarding the notice. We think the answer is no. If the hospital district did not receive notice, they should have said so. They have never done so, and of course the trial court found that the notice in this case was sufficient. Unless the court has further questions, I will yield the balance of my time to counsel for AT&T.
Thank you, Mr. Hawkins.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Mr. Villarreal.
Good morning, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. I'm going to use my time to focus pretty exclusively on the question or the issue that Ms. Hayes raised related to the STA carve-out to the Morales class. As you may know or from our briefing, there was a Rule 11 agreement that was entered into at the settlement at the fairness hearing over this settlement, in which AT&T agreed not to assert res judicata as to specific claims that STA might assert. There are 2 points that I want to make about this that are pretty critical. First of all, this issue was not preserved for appellate review at the PUC, at the district court, rather. And this was an issue that at the district court below, both the state and AT&T objected to and said the district did not raise this issue in its motion for rehearing, and therefore it has been waived. The question of whether or not somehow HCHD was involved in a carve-out of the Morales class. And this was, I just want to read to you HCHD's response to that. The title for the section in which they responded to that is HCHD concedes waiver of its alternative argument that the STA Rule 11 agreement exempts it from the Morales class. And they went on to say, the PUC and AT&T argue that HCHD waived the alternative argument that a certain Rule 11 agreement to carve out certain commercial customers from the Morales class included HCHD for failure to raise in its motion for rehearing. HCHD concedes this issue. So this isn't even a waiver argument like we typically face where one side's saying, we waived it, the other side saying, no, we didn't waive it, and you've got a battle between those two. Here, HCHD has conceded that it waived this carve-out issue. And furthermore, the carve-out issue is just incorrect. If you look at the actual Rule 11 agreement, it's not a carve-out. It is not, at no point does AT&T say, this is the Morales class, which was a global class of everybody who paid this fee, which undoubtedly includes HCHD. At no point did that Rule 11 agreement carve out claims and remove them and say, STA, you can now, these claims are now outside the Morales class. In fact, what happened was AT&T, in order to remove the objection of STA, just said, if you want to go pursue those claims, we're going to just not assert res judicata as those claims. And that's what STA went off and did. It went off and it pursued its claims. That class got certified, then the Supreme Court decertified it, and AT&T settled individually with STA. So that whole side issue just sort of went away, and what's left at the end is the Morellis class with all of its res judicata effects, and it's a global class that undoubtedly includes HCHD within its bounds. I would note also that Ms. Hayes suggested that HCHD was somehow relying on this separate class, that it wasn't sleeping on its rights. As far as I'm aware, I don't know of anything in the record to indicate that HCHD believed itself to be a member of that SDA class. And if there are no further questions, we'd ask for the court to reverse.
Thank you, Mr. Villarreal.
Thank you.
I'll quickly dispense with Mr. Vial's position. We didn't brief it as a Rule 11 issue to this court. We briefed it as a judicial estoppel issue. They successively argued in the lengthy stall litigation that because the class was so diverse, it included governmental entities, that stall was an inadequate representative. And inadequate representation is exactly the issue they won on at the Texas Supreme Court. moving to the rest, and it was Justice Rose, your question about improper billing case was answered with the word rates. Yes, rates are involved in this case, and they underlie everything. 52002 doesn't just speaks in its preamble of rates operation and services, and it continues exclusive original jurisdiction over the business and property of a telecommunications utility. It's that broad. It's been treated that broad by the courts. And jurisdiction means jurisdiction, no matter who the parties are or what apple cart is going to overturn. That is a hard rule of law. Secondly, I want to confess an error in our brief. We referenced the statute about, it's chapter 2254 in the government code concerning contingency contracts. We said it was enacted in 2011, as AT&T did in their brief. That's not true. It was actually enacted in 1999, in May of 1999, which was before the settlement in this case. And it enacts a whole other layer of statutory scheme and restrictions on contingent fee contracts. And there was a reason for that, protecting the public coffers. And if y'all remember back, that wasn't long after an attorney general of our state went to federal prison over contingency fee contracts with lawyers. There's a real reason to protect governments, their representation, and where money goes when a case is settled in their name. And that's another layer of sort of issues with the Morellis settlement, where the money went, how much money there was, the class members got nothing. During the Morellis class action, as it settled in the transcript, counsel represented the claims were only, the damage were only a few dollars per customer. You know, we're here today because HCHD believes the damages just for it alone at the time were in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. That class settled simultaneously with the certification. It didn't go through full discovery about damages.
Counsel, if we were to agree with your position, would this be creating some sort of opt-in for governmental entities in class actions?
It has to. And I know that can be an uncomfortable position. But if governments, I mean, here's where we are, the state of jurisprudence in Texas today. Counties can't have a class action, but they can be sucked into them and lose their rights. The class action procedure is a dangerous one, and the courts have recognized that. It can do great good in judicial economy. It can also cut off claims before plaintiffs have a chance to know what's happening. I quoted to the court in my briefing a quote from Justice Hecht when the rulemaking from the 2003 HB4 tort reforms on class action were going through to the effect of, you know, defendants would be happy to settle a case quickly. You can get that cheaper than you can in bankruptcy court. And we're here today because we believe that's what happened in this case. And because we are a government, we get to go forward. We don't have a statute of limitations. Our representation is protected under the law, as it should be, precisely because of the kinds of things that can go on court to hurt the government coffers and hurt the name of the people, and for whom that's the county attorneys and district attorneys and attorney generals act.
Is there any reason the legislature couldn't specifically put some protection in or some special provision in the class action procedural rules dealing with governmental entities?
Well, the legislature doesn't make the rule. Does the court, the Supreme Court does. They could. They have punted to the Supreme Court to make the rulemaking on class actions. And, you know, and as I said in the beginning, this is an unusual case to have this collision of jurisdictional jurisprudence, governmental representation jurisprudence, which comes up less and less these days, and class actions. And I'll go back to class actions are a procedural device. They're not substantive law. They make final judgments, which are substantive law, but it's also the substantive law that if that court didn't have jurisdiction over that case, that order's void. And this, we're not talking primary jurisdiction here, we're talking subject matter jurisdiction. Every single claim is premised on whether that fee was legally charged. So they're all subject to the PUC's jurisdiction first. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes. Is that all? I don't want to cut anybody off. We had a complex series there. Thank you all very much for a case well argued. The case will be submitted. Court will stand in recess.